Testing 1, 2, 3. This is Dr. Alex Avila with Love University, and we're back. I'm an author, psychologist, and speaker, and every week we talk about how to improve yourself, how to love yourself, others, and a higher power. And every week we have either a great show on some enlightening ideas, and also guests as well. And today we have a really exciting guest. In fact, we have two guests. We have a two-for-one deal. We have Linda Bloom, who's a licensed social worker, and Charlie Bloom, also a licensed therapist, who are seminar leaders, therapists, and relationship counselors in the experts of marriage. They have had over 200 radio and TV programs. They're co-authors of various books, Happily Ever After, 39 Other Myths About Love, a bestseller, 101 Things I Knew Before I Got Married, or When I Got Married, Secrets of Great Marriages, and their newest one, a memoir, That Which Doesn't Kill Us. And they live in Santa Cruz, California. They have two children, three grandchildren, and they've been together for 50 years. Welcome to the show, Linda and Charlie.
I'm delighted to be here with you. Thank you for inviting us.
Yeah, we're very excited. The secrets of marriage, this is an amazing topic. One thing, Linda, looking at your material, it says here you're a recovering shy person. And I wrote a book called The Gift of Shyness that actually talks about some of the positives of shyness, like sensitivity and self-reflection, but also there's a self-consciousness. How did you transform your shyness? What did you do to do that?
Well, my husband was teaching workshops before I was. And I never thought that I would ever be a teacher. I would just do one-on-one and maybe one-on-two counseling.
Right.
I wanted very much to teach with him. So I had to get over my fear of public speaking. And when I started to teach with him, my knees were knocking together.
Oh, yes.
Stomach was roiling, and yes. I just was just frightened as could be.
Right.
And people are so supportive, and they're so encouraging. And I would lock onto a set of eyes out there in the audience, and I would just feel energy coming towards me.
Yes.
It took me actually years to get over my shyness.
I see what you're saying.
I love teaching now, and yes. I'm so glad that I pitted myself against that challenge.
Yeah. And knowing that you're talking quite a bit here and Charlie's been quiet, I'm going to surmise that you're an extrovert and he's an introvert energy.
How did you guess?
Is that right, Charlie? Are you more of an introverted energy person?
Absolutely correct. Okay. As a matter of fact, I've already said as many words as I have to say now.
Okay, you're mailing it in the rest of the show, but we'll pick you up. And, I've written a bestseller, actually, Love Types on Myers-Briggs and Compatibility, you may have heard about. And, the different classifications. So I'm going to guess, Linda, that you might be an ENFJ and maybe Charlie's an INTP. Am I anywhere near?
Well, I'm very social. And when I'm under stress, I need to talk to somebody. And so when Charlie's under stress, he wants to go be alone.
Yes, exactly.
We're very different in those ways that I'm extreme in my social, being a connector.
Of course.
And one of the cornerstones of what we teach is respecting the differences.
Yes.
And learning from each other's differences.
Exactly.
So I think that there's a lot of truth in this old adage about opposites attract when we teach about compliments attract. But I'm very strong in my belief that there's a very deep, wise, natural knowing and intuitive sense that draws us to people who are very different than we are so we can get more mastery in areas where we're not so strong yet.
Exactly. And I think the key is respect each other's style. And I talk about that in the Love Types approach. So I see you as kind of a growth teacher, Linda, and I think, Charlie, are you more of a scholar type? Are you into learning and knowledge and intellect? Is that something that drives you?
Yeah, I do tend to operate on a more abstract level, and Linda is much more concrete, sequential. And
I see. Are you like the absent-minded professor? Like you leave your socks everywhere, but you're a brilliant guy?
Yes.
No, usually it's my underwear that I leave. My socks I can keep track of.
Oh, okay. I get it. Now let's get into some materials here. You got some really great stuff. Now, starting with the myths of marriage and relationships, because people want to have a happy marriage. That's one of the keys of success, research shows, in terms of long-term happiness and also health, physical health, and other things. So this is something I'll ask you a question on, Linda and Charlie. Is it possible that you can live happily ever after, like all throughout the marriage? Is that a truth or myth?
Myth.
Well, I don't know. I've heard that there's a couple in Eastern Asia who have been together for 61 years,
wow,
and they have not ever had an argument. Okay. So it's not true. It is possible.
Okay. Okay.
However, for the other 7.5 billion other people, it's not too likely.
I see. So Linda, the idea of, you've heard the term maybe destiny versus growth marriage, destiny meaning people say, well, either we're meant to be together or we're not. So maybe they throw in the towel if they don't think they're exactly right. But in a growth marriage, they want to improve the marriage and work on it. Which way do you think is the best approach?
Well, I'm all about the growth marriage. I just say it's on the job training. And I think people are setting themselves up for a lot of disappointment and a lot of frustration if they think that there's one right person out there, some soulmate that they won't have to struggle with. That just is a setup for a lot of sorrow. And you know, the statistics bear that out, that the couples who are divorcing, who get married a second time, they have a higher rate of failure.
Yes.
And so it's 60%. They are still under the belief and the myth that there's the right person out there. I just got the wrong person last time. So we're not saying that every marriage needs to be saved, but people do give up early before they've really looked at themselves and see how they can shift or change or become more tolerant and accepting or more assertive and negotiate for their needs and get their conflict management skills up. So we're all about the growth model.
I like that. And one thing I liked about what you said, your materials, you said, instead of looking for the dream partner, you become the dream partner. And here we're talking Love University about loving yourself as well as loving others and a higher nature. So loving yourself first, why is that so important in a great marriage?
Well, I don't know that it always comes first. Although it is important, if you cannot bring self-love into the relationship, what will inevitably happen is you're going to end up holding this other person responsible for filling your love tank. And you're going to be looking to them to give you a sense of wholeness and fulfillment and well-being that, you know, really they don't have the power or the responsibility for. So that can really get into trouble. The challenge then is to use the relationship to become a more loving person. And in doing so, we can come to our relationships bringing a desire to give rather than being needy and looking to them to fill our love tank.
Exactly. Now, the other thing is you talk about feeling love all the time. So in 50 years of marriage, is that possible to feel love all the time? Or are you going to have times when you kind of either don't like them or even get, I wouldn't use the word hate, but maybe resentful toward your partner?
I'll say the love may get buried under layers of resentment and frustration and fearfulness that we're going to not have our needs met and we're not going to be loved properly. I think for many of us, vast majority of the time, the love is down there. But there are so many layers on top. Old wounds from family of origin. Sometimes there's prior relationships where people have been betrayed and let down or abandoned. And there's things that have to be dealt with that are incomplete. And they can keep us from accessing the love that's down there. And we find all the time when we're working with couples, whether we're working with them in a counseling session or in a workshop or an intensive, that they don't realize how much communication and collaboration with goodwill to straighten out the issues and get complete on the old issues. It really takes quite a lot of committed effort over a period of years. And then you can access the love much more easily, even when you're having a frustrating moment. It's just a thought away.
That makes a lot of sense. So working hard in the marriage, you know, so it is work, just like you go to a 9-to-5 job. But a lot of people put 8 hours a day in their work, but they don't put even an hour a day in their marriage. So, and they think they should get results automatically. So I think you're saying that that's not the case. Now, one thing I found really interesting is that you said the thing that all differences need to be resolved is a myth, and that actually it's okay to have ongoing differences, and actually it can even strengthen your marriage. But here's a question I have for you, Linda and Charlie. Let's say that you are very different. Let's say you're different religions. You might be different politically, and maybe even in your sex life, you have different desires in terms of frequency and things like that. How do you make that work? It seems like there's a lot of differences.
Well, we try to distinguish different preferences and views from, and even different temperaments and personalities from things that are much less, we're much less able to influence. So there's a category of differences that we call deal breakers. Uh-huh. And a deal breaker is not something that, it's not like there are certain things that will break your relationship up, but individuals have certain deal breakers. Like there are some people very comfortably, they would be, find it easy to live with somebody who had different political beliefs than they do. Some people find it very comfortable to live with people who have different religions. And then, you know, there are other people who are not so comfortable with that. As a matter of fact, they couldn't imagine living with somebody whose political views are very different from their own.
Yeah, it reminds me of certain current people in the news that are different in their politics, but they seem to be married happily, yeah. I guess. But what do you think about that? Is that possible or is it difficult if you're very strong in your views?
I think it is possible for some people, and it really depends upon whether they have fundamental values, deeper underlying values that are in alignment with each other.
Yes.
And if those values on a deep level are really not congruent with each other, that would make it, I wouldn't say impossible, but it would make it difficult to really have an ongoing committed partnership.
So Linda, you're one religion and Charlie's another, and you have kids. Are you going to say, well, we disagree on religion, but we'll let our kids decide. We'll expose them to both religions. Is that a good approach?
I think that a spiritual orientation will be broad enough to encompass the different rituals and the different beliefs and the different customs of the religions. So if the couple has a spiritual orientation, even if they have go to different churches and maybe they have different preferences about the rituals and beliefs, they can offer both of those orientations to their children and respect the differences. I love the whole symbol of all the major religions are wells into the same underground stream of spirituality. Because the truth is the truth, no matter where you enter it from. And so I think that would be a great example of respecting the differences and modeling that for your children, that you don't make anybody bad and wrong for their belief system, right. And that there's so many different ways to believe in this world. If it gives you a happier life, if it makes you more fulfilled, if you get a lift from that, well, have at it. And everybody needs to make those choices.
Yeah, I mean, and you could say love is the underlying fundamental part of many of these spiritual paths, you know, the compassion and love. Now, I'm going to direct this one to you, Linda. This is one that's interesting. If you love me, I don't need to ask. You should know what I want. Uh-huh. Now, is that a male or female, or is that a both concept?
I think it's more prevalent with women. Ah. And this was one of the romantic myths that got me in a lot of trouble
for
years. Okay. I was so under the gas of the romantic myths back in my 20s into my 30s. Uh-huh. And I thought that because I had to draw Charlie a picture and give him a recipe and stick my neck out there and tell him specifically the ways I wanted to be loved, that I wanted hugs and kisses and for him to look in my eyes and to, you know, lots of physical touch. I'm all about touch. I'm totally touchaholic. And he's not so much that way. And I used to feel sad about it. And I wouldn't go public with my prayer to him. Yes. And for the longest time, I would just have this sadness and feel like, gee, it's just too bad that he doesn't love me too much. I know he loves me some, but it's too bad he doesn't love me too much. Yeah. And it really took me years until I realized that it was my own resistance to getting vulnerable and, you know, bearing myself that way to ask. When I started to be braver, when I started to have some courage and ask for what I wanted, he was happy that I gave him some cues so that he could love me the way I wanted to be loved.
That makes a lot of sense. And so basically, I think you said the fear of rejection. You were maybe afraid that he would not, you know, respond well. And, you know, your love language, I guess you said, is touch and physical affirmation or emotional affirmation. And then what's yours? Charlie, what's your love language?
Well, you know, when Linda asked me how I most wanted to be loved,
yes.
I didn't have one of the five.
Oh, really?
Conventional ones. And okay. I gave her the one that meant the most to me, which is
let go.
Let go. And
oh.
What I meant by that was let go of your efforts to make me the person that you need me to be in order to love you, because I don't feel like I can naturally give you love the way I want to when I'm busy dealing with the pressure that I'm feeling from you to give it in the form that you want it.
Wow.
Linda, wouldn't you say that changed things?
Yes.
Mm. Wow.
And I could accept the many ways that you show love to me that spring forth spontaneously from you and loosen up my white knuckle grip on how I had it shown. And non-attachment was really important for me. And I was, you know, looking so hard in one direction that I was missing all the beautiful ways, things that you were saying, things that you were doing for me, that I was distracted by being too attached to having it come in a certain form.
Right. I like that. So that's like saying a gift is letting go of expectations is an actual internal gift as opposed to
both
external
people.
Gift.
Yes. It's a gift to the person who is receiving that letting go, and it's a gift to the person who themselves are letting go.
Right. But it seems like it could be very hard because people do have a lot of conditional love, you know, as opposed to unconditional, which is agape. So, you know, if you behave a certain way, I'll treat you nice. You know, that's very common among most couples. So how does a man or woman let go of the expectation toward their partner that they want them to be a certain way?
Well, you know, that's where it comes back to what you were saying earlier about self-love. When you have that feeling within yourself that you're okay, that you can respect and honor and love yourself, and even though all the ways that you are may not fit everybody else's expectations, but you can feel a sense of self-acceptance and self-worth as is, as the way you are, then your tendency to require the other person to fulfill those expectations is not going to be so strong. It's going to be a preference rather than a need.
Yes, right. Now, Charlie, you're talking a lot more. What happened? Did you get a little coffee or something, or a little energy here?
No, I came up a little bit.
Okay. It's like introvert people. I'm an introvert myself, actually, but I get a burst of energy, and then I get tired and need to recharge my batteries and go to the hot tub and relax. So the introvert.
I got that one. I'm with you.
You understand what I'm saying?
Now,
Yeah. The other thing is, this was an interesting one. It says, love means never having to say you're sorry. And, you know, people don't like to say they're sorry, but you're telling me that you wish to say we're sorry a lot of the time?
Well, it's a myth if you think that that's loving behavior. Because if you cause harm to somebody, you had better become a champion of repair and clean up and be willing to eat some humble pie and to not only say you're sorry, but to add to that. And what I have learned about this going forward so that I don't harm you again, which I think is even more important than the I'm sorry. Sometimes people say I'm sorry, and then they go and they hurt you again in that same way. And if they really take a look and feel into it with that empathy, and they see how they've wounded you, and they see that, you know, they had tone in their voice, or they were sarcastic, or they were judgmental, or whatever it was that caused the harm, maybe it was a broken agreement, but whatever it was, I think it needs to be specific, not just a toss away, oh, I'm sorry.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it's got to come from the heart, as you say, or authentically. Now, this is an interesting idea, and this actually goes into one of your other very successful books, That Which Doesn't Kill You, and the famous phrase, you know, that which doesn't kill you makes you stronger. But there's some research to show that actually people can become weaker with trauma. I work in forensic psychology with trauma victims, and there's something called the eggshell skull person that, you know, each trauma actually sensitizes the brain to, you know, get weaker when they have a new trauma. And some people are the steel skull brain. They actually get stronger. They get more resilient. And they had did a study with people at 9/11, and they said people that looked at a fearful face and that were close to the World Trade Center, like a mile away, had a lot more activity in their amygdala, which deals with the fear mechanism, those that didn't. So it does seem to do that. But then other people have what we call post-traumatic growth, which actually they get stronger. So how do you see that in marriages? Because I know you did a research with a lot of married couples, some of them have been through infidelity and financial issues, health problems, even homelessness, I think. Who becomes stronger, and how do they become stronger through all these crises?
Yeah, I don't think that it's a function of the nature of the crisis that you go through, but it has to do with the way in which people respond to it. And I agree with you that there are certain people who are maybe just wired in a way that their physiology makes it much more difficult for them to recover from trauma.
Right.
And that which doesn't kill me doesn't necessarily make me stronger. It okay. may be possible for me to cultivate greater strength from it.
Yes.
But that doesn't, there's no guarantee. I mean, there, like you say, there are people who get broken by trauma.
Yes.
That is really, you know, debilitating and have very great difficulty recovering from it. Hmm. So I think that there may be people who experience trauma so severely and that their system isn't capable of fully recovering.
Right. But even aside from the trauma of, some kind of a serious physical injury or assault, just psychologically, the many traumas, maybe even in a marriage, the attacks on each other emotionally. Now, I heard a story of a married couple where the man was a workaholic. He would work 80 hours a week and he would travel all over the country. And the woman was pretty much a single mom for 5 years. Have you heard of that one, Linda?
I'm very familiar with that story.
That's your story, right?
Uh-huh. And I really believe that the post-traumatic growth that yes. came yeah. from that extremely difficult period in my yeah. life mm-hmm. primarily rested on the belief that I could come through it, and I could come through it stronger than I was before. Mm-hmm. That I didn't have to do it all myself, that I could get some good help, and I got really good help. And that as long as I was going to be suffering, I wanted to make some meaning out of the suffering. And if there's anything that I hate, it's meaningless suffering. If you're going to have to suffer through something, whatever it is, whether it's, you know, financial problem or professional problem or marital or health or one with our kids, no matter what it is, that trauma, that suffering, that difficulty, that frustration, that ordeal will bring us down to our knees and force us to have to look at our belief system, force us to have to look at how we've been living our life and what's working for us and what's not, and force us to make some changes such that we can end up being wiser, more empathic, more compassionate, more loving, more patient, more kind, more forgiving, and more courageous. And the possibility is embedded in the crisis, but it begins with believing that it's possible and then utilizing it. And if you're stymied and don't know how to utilize it, get with some professional coach or some friend or some wise person in your friendship network or family who does know the territory, who can help to coach us how to use the material that will flush up during the ordeal.
But what I'm really thinking, Linda, is why did you hang in there and not divorce? Because, you know, they say up to 50% of marriages end in divorce. Was there something about you personally, like, are you a religious person? Are you optimistic? You think that's something that can be taught as well? Are there things you can teach people not to divorce? What's the secret of hanging in there, you know, through these very hard things?
I think it can be taught. And I think that as a therapist, it is not our place to tell a client when to hang in or not hang in. Mm-hmm. But if they want to hang in, there are ways to do that, to find ways to be fulfilled in your life, in friendships, in spiritual practice, enjoying your children, enjoying creative expression, that will fill in some of the gaps while your partner is preoccupied with their career building or whatever it is that they're preoccupied with. Mm-hmm. Also becoming patient, tolerant, And using your commitment muscles that you can hang in there even in the tough times, and reaching down deep to find the love under the layers of disappointment and resentment. And I did have that kind of a good work ethic to do that because we had had 12 years together that were really most of the time quite beautiful before he became a workaholic and he was working the 80-hour week. So I had that to draw on. I just thought he's lost and dazed and confused. He's going to come back if I could just hang in there long enough. And even while I was hating his guts, I was still loving him.
That's great. Those are really like spiritual qualities, patience and those kind of things you're talking about. But let's switch a little bit now. We're talking about myths, but let's talk about secrets of happy marriage. Because I know you've done research also with happily married couples. And you wrote, I think, another book based on that. And I see here one thing that says, give your best energy to the relationship, not necessarily to a career or something like that, which that makes sense. Put the priority on the marriage. But now what if you have children? I've talked to some people that said, well, I still put my marriage first, even above the children, because if we have a bad marriage, the children will suffer. Where do you lie on that? Should the couple just be in the romantic marriage, or should they be a traditional, more for the kids?
Yes.
How did you guys do it? Did you guys get all romantic, or did you put the kids first?
You know, I think having a policy where one or the other always comes first is not really practical. There are times when it looks like you have to make a choice. Somebody's got to be number one on the priority list. And when that's the case, it may sometimes have to be the kids. In general, it's better when the marriage is a very high priority, and when possible, that the couple is able to be on the same page, particularly when it comes to disciplining the kids. Very often, one parent is much more lenient, the other one is less permissive, and that can be really problematic. And then the kids really end up suffering for that because, you know, as we all know, children need a strong authority. Not necessarily somebody who's punitive or dominating, but somebody who is clearly the authoritative person. And when both people can be aligned with that, the children are much better off.
That makes a lot of sense. And how are your children doing now? Are they doing okay in life?
They're doing pretty well, and we have grandkids.
Wow.
And Charlie and I are both from the school of thought that if you can build a really sturdy, committed romantic partnership, that it's a great gift that you give your kids, that they see that it's possible. They see you fight. They see you make up. They see you disappoint each other. They see you repair and put the corrections in. And you know what? Even when you give them a great model of a working partnership, it doesn't ensure or guarantee anything. They've got their own path, and they have to find their own way, and they have to make their mistakes, but at least it gives them a fighting chance to have a good partner.
That makes sense, yeah. And the other thing you said is you see a relationship as a living entity. You see it as a little child. You have to change the diapers and feed it and nurture it. Is that how you see a marriage?
Well, not the diaper part so much. But
well, you have to clean it up a little bit, you said, I think.
There is definitely times that you got to just clean up. But we do. And there's like we say in one of the books, there's three entities. There's you, there's me, and then there's our relationship when all three of us need attention and care and nurturance. And when all three sets of needs are fulfilled, and if we have kids, of course, that when their needs are fulfilled, then the outcome and the process itself is going to be very, very different than when one part of the triangle is being neglected.
Yes.
And so I think people don't often just don't realize what we're really taking on when you commit yourself to a marriage, or when you commit yourself to being a parent and you have children. The difference between living as a single individual and then taking on a commitment to the well-being of another person or other people is just way beyond what most people think it's going to be. And I think We know a lot of people who said, boy, it's a good thing that I didn't know what I was in for.
Exactly. It's too late now, but I'm happy no matter what.
I would have done it.
Exactly. Now, one thing you guys talk about, and I actually also talk about it, is the idea that marriage is not necessarily 50-50, because there may be times when it's 90-10, like you're tired, and the other person picks you up, or vice versa, they pick you up, or 80-20. How do you guys see that part of it in terms of the changeable variability of marriage? You know, how much people put into it?
You go through many phases. And hopefully, if you've been the one that's been carrying the commitment for two people and you've been carrying 90% of it and they've only carried 10, that will shift. So over the long haul, more equal. It becomes more egalitarian. It will just exhaust and burn out the person who's feeding the relationship, who's taking care of the relationship, who's bringing up the subjects that need to be ironed out. And that gets really old.
Yeah, the codependent style, you say.
And really, the best relationships, and we did that anecdotal study with the 50 happiest couples that we could find, they all said the same thing. They take good care of their relationship. They check in with each other regularly. They have zero tolerance for letting things lay around untended to. They clean up the relationship. They do go on date night. They go on romantic getaways.
Yes.
Some of them honeymoon every year. Mm. I think that's a splendid idea.
I like that idea. That's good.
They realize that you have to take good care of the relationship to keep it in good shape.
Exactly.
And when we see couples in trouble, it's sometimes revolutionary thought to them that the relationship is the failure to thrive, baby. Do you know they haven't been feeding it? They haven't been tending it. They haven't been checking in with each other.
Yeah.
They haven't been having enough fun.
Yeah, they spend more time on their car tuning it up maybe than on tuning up their marriage. And then they wonder why it was not working well. Now here's one that's very interesting, and I thought this was pretty cool, Linda. You said that happily married couples are slightly delusional in terms of seeing each other in a very in their best light. Now, is it possible to be a little bit delusional and be happy in a marriage?
Yes, I think that's okay. And, there's a piece of research that they interview people who know the husband, and they give him ratings about this and that and the other thing. And then they ask the wife, and she gives them much higher ratings.
Oh, wow.
And sometimes it goes the other way. They interview the friends of the wife, and then they ask the husband. And they say, oh, she's so kind, and oh, she's so patient, and oh, she's so nurturing, and she's a terrific cook and a terrific housekeeper and all these things. And you know what? It makes them feel real good to live in that kind of gratitude for hitting the jackpot and getting a terrific spouse.
Yeah, because I'm thinking of the newlywed game when they actually do the opposite. They don't know each other that well, and they say all those different things. Why do you think they could do it in this kind of marriage where they are a little bit maybe unrealistic? You say they only look at the best parts.
Yeah, I think accountability is where we choose to focus our attention. And you can focus on the person's flaws and their deficiencies and their weaknesses, or you can make a conscious choice to look at their beauty and emphasize that and put the accent on that.
That makes a lot of sense, yeah. And I agree with you. I think more positives to less negatives works a lot better. Now, the other idea is what we call the childhood trigger points. For example, let's say you had a mom or dad who was very cold to you and maybe you felt abandoned. And then as an adult married person, your spouse doesn't text you back immediately and you think, he doesn't love me anymore and that kind of thing. So how do you deal with these sensitive trigger points from childhood that people may have in their marriage that, they're really hurt deeper because of their past?
Well, if you're able to recognize what it is that really did activate you and what triggered you, and you can talk about that and you can connect the dots to previous experiences that you had in your life and you can acknowledge that, then what will get diffused is the anger towards the other person, and the other person will begin to understand, now I see why you got so upset and I'm not taking it so personally because I see that it wasn't, it wasn't just because of me, but there was this whole backlog of stuff that was there that, I just dropped a match in the kindling and the whole thing got inflamed.
Yes.
So being able to recognize what our trigger points are, where they may have come from, how to communicate that in a way that doesn't blame and hold the other person responsible for, but is honest about the feelings of being hurt or disturbed or fearful or angry even. But if we can recognize that most of the time when we have this unfinished business within ourselves and we get triggered, the immediate natural response is to
get
angry at the person that may feel this way.
Right. It sounds like they might need some individual therapy work if they want to do that.
It can be really helpful because that can help you to recognize what the source and the origin is of some of the reactive feelings.
Exactly. You know, one thing that I found very beautiful in your materials is the idea of empathy and really having a deep understanding of another, which I think is really love, is when you really embrace and understand someone deeply at a deep level, as opposed to some people say they want to be right instead of being happy. You know, their ego gets in the way. But you said something very beautiful here, Linda. You said that you are the guardian of your husband's solitude because he's an introvert, and you actually value that and even guard it. I thought that was an amazing statement that you said that, you know, as an empathetic person, because you know the value that he puts on that. But that's pretty rare. Do you think couples have that immense empathy for each other?
Yes, I do. I think the happiest couples have very deep empathy. And for a long time, I took it so personally that Charlie wanted to have a lot of time alone.
Yes.
And I felt personally rejected by that.
Yes.
He doesn't love me very much. He maybe finds me boring. Maybe he finds me needy. I was making up all kinds of stories about it.
Yes.
And when I really felt into him, and his experience is so different from mine, and I had empathy for how sensitive he is, and he gets overstimulated, and he needs to be by himself and have these meditative pauses.
Yes.
And when I felt that aching in him to be alone is like my aching to be connected to people. And, you know, he's a freedom fighter and I'm a big time connector.
Right.
And when I could feel how his longing just to have quiet and peace and alone and not to be interfered with or interrupted, that's when I could say, it's not about me. It's about him and his style of being in the world, which is so different from mine. But I love him and I want him to be happy. And I took a holy vow on our wedding anniversary, years after our actual wedding, when I said, I understand you more deeply now and what you need to thrive. And I am going to remind you to go away on retreat frequently.
Wow.
You can go every month if you want to. And he won't go as often as I try to encourage him.
That's incredible.
But it's enlightened self-interest on my part because he's so present with me when he comes back after he's been alone for a few weeks.
Exactly. Yeah, Charlie, isn't that great? You know, us being introverts, to have someone that appreciates our introvert nature.
Oh, it's incredible.
It's amazing.
And you know, the irony, the paradox is that the more Linda supported me in taking care of myself in that way, the more I wanted to give back to her.
Yes.
And I ended up, she gave me permission to take the time I needed. I ended up needing to take less time because that I was already feeling fulfilled and I wanted to give back to her to show my appreciation. So in her letting go and encouragement, she ended up getting way more back than she got before.
Right, exactly. So it's a paradoxical effect. You felt pressured before, but once the pressure was released, then you could really give her more.
I felt was gratitude.
And now
and more love.
I get morning cuddling meditation every morning.
Wow. Are we going to get more grandkids or something? Or what's going on here?
No.
No more. That's awesome. So that's really beautiful that way you said that. And the other thing is a reversal is what I like to see sometimes. I see another reversal here is that instead of focusing on what's wrong with your partner, focus on what you can do to bring out the best in them. And you say you have a special question. You say, how may I best love you? How does that work with couples?
Mm-hmm. We say that that's one of the most important questions that you can ask your beloved. mm-hmm. is how may I best love you. And you don't just ask one time because it shifts and changes. And maybe they want solitude today, but maybe they want words of affirmation tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So to really live in that question. We also have the phrase that we use when we teach our classes, believing eyes, that you can see your partner's potential and their signature strengths and their abilities that are still in bud form, that haven't matured and flourished yet. And this is a profound way to love your partner in a very proactive way, is to hold up the mirror to them and to believe in them and say, I know that this is a talent of yours. This is a gift for you to give the world. It's your unique gift to give the community. And I believe in you. And how is there a way in which I can support you to be more fully who you can be?
That's amazing. But you know, Linda, I think you and I are kind of meaning seeker optimists, you know, maybe even spiritual. And we see the potential in people. But I also work, unfortunately, with people who have very, I would say, unhealthy relationships. So if you have someone who has a personality disorder, let's say someone who's narcissistic, maybe sociopathic personality, it's not necessarily your issue, but it's actually their issue in that case. What do you do if, unfortunately, you fall into that kind of pattern with a partner that is abusive, maybe emotionally or even physically? Where do you draw the line in these things?
Well, we know that everyone has angels and demons in their consciousness and in their psyche. And hopefully our own judgment will lead us to somebody who is much more balanced in the angelic side. But if we happen to find ourselves in relationship with people who are very, very difficult or who have addictions or who have behaviors that they don't feel that they can really manage or control, well, it becomes a deal breaker if they're not willing to get help for it.
I see.
In other words, somebody can, you know, we all have weaknesses, and and sometimes those weaknesses can really disable us.
Right.
But if we're willing to get help and really participate actively in the healing process, then that can be workable. But it's the situations where there's no motivation, no willingness to seek assistance and to seek help, where a situation becomes a deal breaker.
Yeah, especially with personality disorders, you know, they often don't recognize they have a problem. They think you have the problem.
Oh,
And they make your life miserable. You know, the borderlines. Have you seen those before?
Well, yeah, and we are very aware that when somebody is in relationship with someone like that, it is very irresponsible to continue to support that, to enable them to be abusive or to be destructive or self-destructive.
Yes.
And sometimes the most loving thing you can do is to end the relationship.
Yeah, so it could be a tough love kind of scenario, right? You're, in a sense, loving them by leaving them so they can get help.
Sometimes that's what it takes for their survival and for your survival.
Exactly. Now, you do mention something about a self-sustaining system. What do you mean by that?
Well, when a partnership is on a roll, it's because both people have participated fully in putting a system in place that addresses both people's needs, both people's styles, uses their signature strengths. And it will take years, really, to put that system in place until it rolls and rolls along in a pretty smooth, functional way. And every couple needs to design and specifically tailor the way in which they're going to be with each other. In our very first book, 101 Things I Wish I Knew When I Got Married, one of the most controversial one-liners in the book is, a marriage is anything two people agree to. Mm-hmm. Some more traditional people just thought that was way too California freeform. We really believe that couples need to take responsibility for writing their own scripts for their life. If they didn't feel that their family of origin was a good model for them, they find out if there was anything good in that model and just extract that out. They may need may go to books. They may need to get to know intimately couples that they admire and put a collage together of what that would look like, and then have thousands of conversations with each other to individualize what it is that will really help them both to thrive, with this relationship being the hub of the wheel. So that their work and their kids and their family and their spiritual practice and their creative expression, that all the domains of their life work, but that this is the centerpiece.
Yes, very well said. Now, one thing you say, that a failure to confront, I guess you would say feelings, is a failure to love. And there's a term called emotional granularity in psychology, where people that are very specific in saying how they feel often have more emotional intelligence. They do better in relationships. You know, I feel happy, joyful, sad, or bitter. How important is that to express your feelings in a relationship, in a marriage?
Well, we feel that honesty and integrity is foundational. And so if you have upset feelings that you cannot clear, then the only responsible thing to do, if you made your best effort to handle it internally, is to speak up respectfully and to do it with as much kindness and consideration as you can, but speak to your partner about this and such is not really working for me. And what would work better for me is, and help them to see an alternative. We're flower children from the 60s, you know. It was a slogan back then.
Yes.
If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem.
Oh, okay. I remember
and
that.
We believe in that. We believe in being proactive and being responsible.
Right. Also, make love, not war. Wasn't that another big one?
Oh, yes. We're very, very much in tune with that and believe in that.
That's a good one, huh? Now,
yeah.
Let me ask you now, a lot of stuff sounds wonderful, but I'm going to look at a skeptical side of the audience that says, well, what about a lot of people out there that, you know, not into the whole self-actualization movement, you know, and they're very practical folks, and maybe even males who are very logical, and they say, why go to therapy? I don't believe in marital therapy. And I do have a lot of women I work with who have been victims of domestic violence and other things, and their husbands will never go to therapy. Part of it's cultural. You know, we work with Latino culture, but I mean, men do still have that kind of stigma. So what do you do in that case if the man refuses to go to marital therapy?
Yes. I think that the motivated partner, and you're absolutely right, it's usually the women, can get a lot of guidance and see what their options are. And that if the therapist has a systems orientation, she is not going to take sides, and she's going to be thinking of his well-being also in addition to hers, and give her ideas of things to try out at home, like appealing to his enlightened self-interest, because everybody is motivated by self-interest. What's in it for me? And if she can frame the things that she is needing to thrive, and she brings those to him in a respectful way, and she can get him to understand that he's going to have a happier life when he has a happy wife.
Yes.
He may be motivated to take a look. There's going to be less arguing in the house. There's going to be more sex in that house.
Yes.
And
yes,
things are going to be more harmonious. People don't want to live, you know, disconnected from people that they love, and they don't want to argue consistently. And so if she can appeal to him in a way that makes sense to him, he may never set foot in the therapist's office. He may never come to one marriage counseling session. He may never attend a seminar or read any of the great relationship books, but he can get something out of it and get some success in his marriage via his wife's bringing the message home.
Yeah, that makes sense. And when you say enlightened self-interest, I'm assuming enlightened meaning appealing to his higher nature or something good inside that man or that woman.
Exactly.
And that brings us to the spiritual marriage, which I thought was a really, really wonderful concept. Again, another reversal is that you use a relationship as part of your inner spiritual practice. So in other words, it's like a vehicle for you to achieve. You talk about things like courage, patience, tolerance, and forgiveness, which I consider a part of love intelligence, love IQ, is these, you know, inner traits are very, very powerful, but they're internal. So that's a whole different way of looking at relationships, because most of the time people think of relationships or marriage as, you know, companionship, sex, or family, or children, or security, but not spiritual growth. How did you guys evolve in that, into that idea?
Well, being in the field of therapy really gave us a head start on that. And then attending workshops and finding that some of the people that we respected the most had a deep spiritual orientation.
Yes.
And so we believe that the work that we do is very deep. Relationship is spiritual practice.
Yes.
And I know a lot of people think about spiritual practices. They go to church and they say prayers, and the prayer and the hymns, the meditations are their spiritual practice. And you can do that and you can feel very sweet and open-hearted while you're in the church or the synagogue or the mosque. And then you go home and that's where the rubber meets the road, because weakness that you might have been feeling while you were in the temple can leave when you have to deal with, you know, the kids and your partner's different style of doing things.
Yes.
And so if you can practice being centered, being mindful, you know, being fully present, then your relationship becomes an extremely important part of your spiritual practice.
Hmm.
And Stephen Levine was a really important teacher to both Charlie and myself. And he says, you can sit in the cave for years and meditate, and then you have to go back into the family and you can lose it in a nanosecond.
Yes.
And so that's where the real practice goes on. Can you keep your center? Can you keep your cool? Can you keep your calm in the midst of a squabble?
Exactly. And patience to me is a huge virtue, and people underestimate it. You know, for example, you rush around in traffic or people get very frustrated, but having patience toward each other, I imagine, is a very strong spiritual trait. But here's the problem, though. What if one of them is spiritual and the other one is not? They say unequally yoked in that sense. Can one person turn the other person spiritual if they're not?
Well, I don't think you can turn a person spiritual. But I do believe, we call that the mixed marriage. You know, back in the old days, the mixed marriage used to be different races and different religions.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, we see a lot of these pairs where one of them is deeply spiritual, very, very into spiritual teachings and practices of different kinds and into personal growth. And the other person's got a more practical, you know, brass tack orientation.
So I'd rather play with my tools or, make potato chips and then go to church or be spiritual.
Yes. And those couples can be happy together. And the person who is really not interested in religion or spirituality or personal growth, they don't have to convert. They can live peacefully. If the person who is interested in spirituality as a personal growth path can respect the differences and find the love and the beauty for that partner, even though they're very different from they are. Where you get into trouble is when you start being judgmental, critical, and controlling, and trying to convert somebody who really isn't interested.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Pygmalion complex. People think after getting married, you want to shape that person to your image, but that creates only resentment and frustration in both parties. But that, I think that deep acceptance and that deep understanding is really a big part of love, as we say, the understanding, the empathy, and the compassion. And speaking of that, I saw something that was very also very beautiful here from you guys, which I think can be a great tip to our listening audience, is that you guys renew and add marital vows. I think you said Valentine's and anniversary. So twice a year, you come up with some new stuff, I guess, for your marriage. And one of them, I think you said, was, I will be your believing eyes. I will call forth your greatness. That's an amazing thing to say to somebody, your spouse. And do you believe that?
Absolutely. That's really foundational in my relationship with Charlie. To be the guardian of his solitude is foundational in our relationship. To stretch into each other's world, we've also vowed to that. One year, I couldn't come up with anything to add to the many things I had already vowed to, because we renew some of the old ones and we add something fresh.
Right.
And I said, I can't come up with anything new. Is there something that you would like from me? And he said, do you know what I would really like? I would like you to vow to me that you will take better care of yourself.
Are you the person that overworks sometimes and cares too much for others?
I do sometimes overgive and overcommit and overwork. Yes.
Oh, I see.
And I have been living that vow, and I have been getting my work and play balance more in good stead. We have taken 3 international trips this year.
Oh, wow.
And so we've had some splendid time vacationing. I don't ever want to retire because I am enjoying my career so much.
Yes.
I feel like I'm at the top of my game, and I can't imagine anything that would be more enjoyable to me.
Exactly. Now, is that a vow that you made to him, or he made to you, that one?
To take better care of myself?
Yes. Is that for you to him, the vow?
Charlie didn't have to make that vow to me because he's always been a champ.
Oh, okay.
He's my only guru about self-care.
But Charlie, do you have another vow for her? Can you make better pancakes for her, or what can you do?
He's gone to his session now. He's got a client call, so I'm going to finish up with you.
Okay.
But Charlie has made vows to me that are very meaningful to me.
I see.
And this one about having the cuddling meditation in the morning really lights me up because we get up early.
Wow.
And, you know, to have skin contact and to really connect in a meaningful way before it's even light out, I'm already having a great day. So I've got a full soul tank, and it's like, come on, challenges. I'm for you. I can write these blogs. I can teach
beautiful.
You. And I thrive, you know, when I feel solidly connected to him. So that's been meaningful to me, and that's been a big stretch for him because he's a very self-sustained system. He doesn't need a whole lot of contact to thrive. And he's a low maintenance man. He doesn't need much from me.
Yeah.
But I'm a connector, and I need a lot. And so he stretches into my world.
Yeah, you guys are amazing inspiration to a lot of people. You know, a happily married couple for almost 50 years. It's amazing. And it kind of goes with my philosophy of, you know, the reason for people to be together, you know, couples or married couples, is to create light in the world, to create, you know, some kind of positive energy, whether it's through their children or maybe working together or maybe just being loving people to others. And I think you guys are really the personification of that. It's a joy to have you here. The one final thing I want to ask you now, we do have actually single people listen to us quite a bit. I do a lot of workshops in that area. And I have actually my producer here, Reggie, who's a young man, mid-20s, actually never really had a relationship. He's very shy. So I wonder if you can give him a little bit of advice for the single folks on finding the right person. So Reggie, say hello to Linda. She's here for you.
Hi, Linda.
Hi, Reggie.
Now, Linda, should Reggie choose a woman that has good looks or good heart or smarts? Let's say he can only choose one. Which would you tell him to choose?
I would say heart.
Really? Reggie, what do you think about that, heart?
I could see that. I think that's important.
Okay, but you still want a good-looking woman or no?
Yeah, for sure, but preferably both. But I think heart's important.
Okay, so he wants both. What do we do, Linda?
I would say the best possible way to go about finding a suitable partner is, you're in your 20s, Reggie?
Yeah, that's right.
They call them the trying 20s because you're supposed to try a lot of things. I want you to try different ideas for career and different ideas for spiritual practice and definitely try out different kinds of women. Because the more you get to know about how you are with different kinds of women, by the end of your 20s, you will be in a position to make a choice that is likely to last a lifetime.
Wow.
Because you'll have grown yourself and learned about who you are in relationship to other, in relationship to romance. And you will also know, this kind of woman wouldn't work for me. She may be beautiful, but she's not enough in her heart. Or this kind of person is really such a heart person, but I need to have more intellectual stimulation and challenge and going back and forth. And so it's different for everybody. And to get in the game, be willing to make some mistakes, it's all fall down, get up, fall down, get up, begin again, begin again. And there really are no real mistakes. It's just all learning. The only real mistake is if you don't play.
I like that. So what do you think of that, Reggie, that advice?
I think it makes sense. It's
helpful. So what will you do this week to apply this advice? He says, keep trying, you know, meeting different women. So what will you do this week?
Well, I mean, I'll just keep going out, you know, trying to put myself out there, initiate conversations when the opportunities arise. Yeah, just like little things, you know, work toward that.
Okay, you think that's going to work, Linda?
Yes, I think it works when people get real early on. You don't have to tell any, you know, dark, shadowy things on the first date or the first. But there are a lot of people in my field who really think you're supposed to keep the image up for the first several months. Mm. And I'm not a believer in that. Okay. I believe early on, get real, get authentic, put your worst foot forward. Okay. You know, don't have an image up. Get off on a good footing by being authentic.
Right. So Reggie is a sweet, sensitive, kind of like a technology, artistic kind of guy. So he has to have his painter's hat on and talk about art and movies. Right, Reggie? All right, Linda. Well, thanks. I really appreciate having you on board today. This has been actually one of our most comprehensive and in-depth sessions we've had. And where can people learn more about you? You have a website. Do you guys offer any services or products?
Yes, we have a website, and it's Bloomwork, BLOOMWORK.com. Yes. It's not Bloomworks. That's plural. It's Bloomworks singular. Okay. And we also are known by Breakthroughs for Couples.
Oh.
So if they can remember Linda Bloom, Charlie Bloom, Bloomwork, or Breakthroughs for Couples, it will all take them to our site.
Uh-huh.
And for your listening audience, we got all kind of free stuff on our site.
Really? Oh.
So you can get three free ebooks.
Oh, wow.
And we do Facebook Live every single Wednesday.
Uh-huh.
Thursday, excuse me, from 12:30 to 1:00.
Wow.
And so we give away free practical wisdom about relationship. Mm-hmm. If you can't tune in at 12:30 on Thursday, they're all in archives. For the people who don't play on Facebook, they're on YouTube. And we've got 400 plus blogs out there on the blogosphere.
Wow.
So there's all kinds of free stuff. And if people want to buy our books, you can see all of our books on our website, 101 Things I Wish I Knew When I Got Married and The Secrets of Great Marriages and The Myths book. And the most recent one is the memoir, That Which Doesn't Kill Us. And you will see our schedule that we're going to teach on the East Coast in Massachusetts at Kripalu in January. And in April, we're going to be at the brand new Personal Growth Center in Scotts Valley at 1440 Multiversity. And we'll be teaching Secrets of Great Relationship in both places, Kripalu and 1440.
That's perfect. If you ever get down to the LA area or, you know, Southern California, I'd love to maybe meet with you, or maybe we can do something together, a seminar or workshop.
That'd be great.
Because you know, we have similar interests in positive psychology. And basically, I think you said it one time, is that love is the fundamental part of this. You know, love is the ultimate energy that we all want to create. And marriage is one vehicle, and there are other vehicles through career as well. But that's one of the most intimate and powerful ones. So again, this has been Love University, Dr. Avila. If you want to reach us and ask any questions about today's show, you can reach us at lovetype4u@AOL.com. That's LOVETYPE, the number 4, letter U at AOL. Also go to loveuniversity.love. Like us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And again, thank you very much, Linda, and your wonderful husband, Charlie, for this great session today. And students, put away your laptops, your iBooks, your iPhones. Love University is now dismissed.